If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Phone app. Now 7 o'clock.
Good morning. Democrats will get a vote this week on their plan to extend health insurance subsidies. Republicans have their own plan. Neither are expected to pass. So what are millions of Americans planning to do? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, West Contra Costa Unified cuts a deal with Teamsters, not teachers. I'm Brian Watt.
The Kremlin is cheering a new White House national security memo. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The security plan suggested the U.S. would support far-right parties in Europe and that immigration would erase European civilization.
Also, Paramount is making a hostile bid to buy Warner Brothers. What could make the offer from Trump ally David Ellison of Paramount more appealing than what Netflix put in? It's Monday, December 8th. On this day in 2012, Texas A&M quarterback Johnny Manziel became the first freshman to win the Heisman Trophy.
News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case that could upend the balance of powers in the federal government. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, the Trump administration has asked the high court to overturn a 90-year precedent.
In 1935, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Congress could put limits on the president's power to fire heads of some independent agencies. The agency in question was the Federal Trade Commission. Today, the court considers whether those limits are constitutional. The new case started with Trump's removal of FTC Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter in March. She was told her service was inconsistent with the administration's priorities. Slaughter sued, calling her firing illegal, and a lower court agreed with her, citing the 1935 case. The Trump administration says that ruling was flawed and should be overturned. They argue the Constitution puts the president in charge of the entire executive branch and Congress cannot siphon that power away from him. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Stocks open mixed this morning as China's trade surplus grows. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 81 points in early trading.
China's exports to the United States have dropped sharply in the face of President Trump's tariffs, but China's still finding plenty of customers elsewhere around the world. The country's overall exports in November were up nearly 6% from a year ago, and China's trade surplus for the year topped $1 trillion for the first time. Paramount is challenging Netflix over its planned purchase of Warner Brothers Discovery. Paramount's going to shareholders with a counteroffer. President Trump said the Netflix acquisition, quote, could be a problem because the combined company's outsized market share. And one of Berkshire Hathaway's top stock pickers is leaving for a job with J.P. Morgan Chase. Todd Combs also ran Berkshire's Geico insurance business. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Demonstrators in New Orleans are continuing to call for an end to federal immigration operations in their area. Videos are surfacing of masked men chasing people down the streets into their homes. Protesters say the enforcement efforts violate people's rights and create fear. Area resident Christine Ravello is working with activists to warn others when ICE operations are nearby. She says they blow whistles.
We're being kidnapped. Okay? They're like hunting us down like we're some type of deer or an animal. We're not. So the story behind the whistle is to let our community know, hey, we're here, don't come out. We have your back.
Despite local Democratic opposition in New Orleans to the effort, Louisiana's Republican governor supports it. A major earthquake has struck the ocean just north of Japan. The U.S. Geological Survey says its magnitude is 7.6. Japanese officials have now issued a tsunami warning. They warn that tsunami waves of nearly 10 feet could wash into central Japan's coast very soon. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The number of workers on strike at the West Contra Costa Unified School District today will be less than late last week. That's because the district reached a tentative agreement with food service and clerical staff represented by the Teamsters over the weekend. But no deal has been reached with teachers who plan to be on strike again for higher pay and smaller classes today. District officials say they're reviewing a counterproposal from the United Teachers of Richmond, and talks could resume tomorrow. Medical experts at UC Berkeley say a lack of data on female bodies has left women athletes at a higher risk of injury. KQED's Aya Ali Ahmad reports a new initiative aims to address that problem.
For decades, sports medicine has relied primarily on data from men, applying it to women for everything from concussion protocols to ACL recovery. Dr. Sydney Chang was the first female head team physician at UC Berkeley.
Less than 10% of sports medicine and sports science research has involved exclusively women athletes. Without that baseline epidemiological data, we have no idea how our interventions are going to impact injury rates and performance.
The new initiative will collect voluntary biometric data from Cal athletes to create predictive models for female physiology. Researchers say these tools will also help protect female firefighters and soldiers. I'm Aya Ali Ahmad, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. Good morning.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University with degrees in tech and business for AI-driven economy, sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And the listeners of KQED. Mel Baker with KQED Traffic as we learn details about a Marin County sig alert.
It's in San Rafael on 101 southbound. Before North San Pedro Road, the two left lanes are blocked. Traffic is effectively nearly stopped back to Roland Boulevard as part of this sig alert. Three vehicles are involved here blocking those lanes. And then in the backup, there is another crash just after the Miller Creek bus stop, but that one's being pushed to the shoulder. Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, the backup now begins at about Cutting Boulevard to the toll plaza. Slows again from the west end to Sir Francis Drake Boulevard. Mel Baker for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Glime, the jeweler. On KQED News with Brian Watt from Oakland this morning at 8:22, one of California's biggest draws is the large number of national parks. Now employees for the parks are bracing for another change from the Trump administration, this time how DEI comes up at gift shops. What does that mean in practice? The story and more on KQED News. Catch it next hour. We are catching up with some dense fog around parts of the valley today in the Bay Area, according to the National Weather Service. Some cloud cover and then slowly becoming sunny on this Monday. Highs not too warm today still. Lower 50s, low to mid 60s are forecast around the Bay Area. It looks like it's going to be dry through the rest of the week into the weekend.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The enhanced healthcare subsidies that were created during the COVID pandemic will expire at the end of the month unless Congress acts quickly.
California Republican Kevin Kiley says it's time for both parties to work together to avoid major spikes in premiums.
There is perhaps no single question that has greater stakes for affordability in America in the coming year than doing something about the expiration of these tax credits.
In a few minutes, we'll hear from people across the country who are facing higher insurance costs next month on the tough decisions they're facing. And we'll look at the data on who is expected to have to pay the most. But we start with what the parties in Congress have done in the past few weeks to address these expiring subsidies.
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh has been watching. So Deirdre, as part of the deal to end the shutdown last month, Democrats were promised a Senate vote on health care. What will they be presenting?
Well, there is no bipartisan deal. So Democrats rolled out their own plan last week, which is a 3-year extension of the existing tax credits. And there's going to be a vote on Thursday on that. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says all Democrats are going to vote for that. He says Republicans can't agree on any plan of their own. And the only option on the table right now is to pass this straight extension.
Democrats are fighting to lower health care costs. Republicans are fighting with one another.
But the Democrats' plan is not expected to get the 60 votes needed to advance in the Senate.
Okay, so what do Senate Republicans want?
Well, they're split. Some Republicans do back extending the subsidies. You know, 24 million people currently rely on them. But GOP lawmakers say there needs to be some kind of income caps to limit who gets these subsidies and some reforms. Senate Majority Leader John Thune dismissed the 3-year extension that Democrats are proposing. He says it's not a serious proposal. Louisiana Republican Bill Cassidy is pushing Thune and Republican leaders to allow a vote on his proposal. That would redirect money the government spends to subsidize ACA plans and instead give them directly to consumers and set up health care savings accounts. Cassidy talked about this on Fox News Sunday.
We want to give an additional choice, one in which your premium is lower and that you have money in an account to help pay for it.
So Thune hasn't decided if the Republicans are even going to put up an alternative for a vote. Even if Republicans do move forward with something like Cassidy's plan, that doesn't have the votes to advance in the Senate either. You know, these are shaping up to be messaging votes. Right now, there's not an effort to get agreement on something that can actually become law.
Okay, so what about the House?
Well, House Speaker Mike Johnson is planning to release a health care bill this week. He's promising a vote this month, but we don't have any details on what's going to be in it, and he's not negotiating with any Democrats. Like Senate Republicans, House Republicans are also divided. Some like the health savings account approach Cassidy's talking about, but there are other House Republicans from swing districts who are teaming up with Democrats to push bills. They call for 1 or 2 year extensions of these subsidies with some reforms.
All right, so we've talked about the Senate and the House. What about the White House? Where is the president on this debate?
Well, the president has mostly been on the sidelines. You know, some Republicans from competitive districts I talked to last week say they've reached out to him and the White House to talk about the policy and the politics about the need to extend these subsidies in some form. But President Trump has not endorsed any legislation. Members of both parties agree on one thing. If Trump doesn't get involved to negotiate some kind of deal soon, these major increases in healthcare premiums are going to happen in January, and they will definitely be a major issue in the 2026 midterms.
That's NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Hopefully those are not wolves at your door, Deirdre, just dogs. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
NPR has been speaking with people who expect to pay more for health insurance if Congress can't come to an agreement on subsidies this month.
Yeah, back in November, we spoke to Chris O'Donnell. He lives in Virginia, and at the time, he said he was expecting his family to pay an additional $1,300 a month for health care in the year ahead. Late last week, we checked back in with him, and he wasn't hopeful.
I will be pleasantly surprised if Congress does anything to help. I'm not expecting it. Moving forward with the assumption that my premiums next year are going to be $21.55 a month.
So he's been looking at the money he has and...
I can pay it barely. I basically have to redirect all this money I was planning on putting towards retirement or savings in general towards healthcare premiums. But according to the spreadsheet that I built with all my finances, we'll scrape by.
Hannah Panuski lives in Georgia. She got married this year.
We had thoughts in mind for next year to like buy a house, start a family. And now with the subsidies going away and our insurance practically doubling, we're just really questioning what exactly we can afford.
She says she can't go without insurance, so she expects to get another plan through the federal marketplace, even if subsidies go away.
It doesn't make sense for us to not have health insurance at all, and it does feel like the only option, unfortunately.
Eric Krause in New Jersey tells us he might just go without coverage. He says his wife just got a new job with health care, but he doesn't know if it'll be any cheaper than an ACA plan. If they do the math and find they can't afford it,
then I will forego health insurance for the year.
Krause says he has a marketplace plan now, and it's already too expensive.
I just had a child, and maybe having that child, if I had to pay the full $40,000 of the hospital bill, would I see maybe a couple thousand dollars in benefit from having health insurance, which is ridiculous.
If the subsidies go away, Krause expects that the people who will keep their policies will be older, sicker Americans who have no choice.
You're going to lose all of these people who are healthy, who are young, and the system seems to depend on that, so... I don't think that the Republicans are even considering that.
Those voices are just some of the millions of Americans who are expected to pay more for health care premiums if Congress doesn't pass a bill this month. The average premium will more than double, according to KFF Health News, the nonpartisan health policy organization which ran the numbers. Gerard Anderson has been sizing up who is likely to pay the most. He's a professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So, Professor, who is in for the sharpest increase if Congress can't come to an agreement?
So anyone who makes about $50,000 to $200,000 a year is going to have the greatest increases in their premiums, simply because the subsidies that were, additional subsidies that were put in, really benefited that population the greatest.
All right. Now, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of people. What is driving those differences? Is it where people live, how old they are, or something else?
It is all of the above. Everybody is unique. It depends on how sick you are, what plan you are, what are the other plans in the area, whether or not you originally had a more expensive plan and now can go down to a less expensive plan. So everyone is going to have a very different experience. The typical person will end up paying about twice as much in a premium, but that's just the average person. Everyone will have it uniquely affect them.
Professor, this net is starting to sound very, very wide in terms of who's going to be affected a lot by this.
Yeah, it's going to be about 4 million people that are going to lose coverage. There'll be another 10 million people that will probably have less coverage. But all of us will, in fact, be affected, because what will happen is the doctors in the hospitals will all of a sudden see more patients that can't pay. And when that happens, they'll need to raise their rates. And when the rates get increased by the hospitals and physicians, insurance premiums for everybody who has private insurance will increase. So that's 150 million people. So it's not just the 4 million that are going to lose coverage, the 10 million that will have less coverage, but it's all people who have private insurance are going to be affected. Maybe not immediately, but certainly within a year.
Now, we just heard from some people on these marketplace plans a few minutes ago that someone said that they would have to make the budget work somehow. One said that he might skip insurance altogether. Do you expect many people will drop healthcare, just completely say no more healthcare for me, at least for now, if they lose subsidies?
I think you will expect about 4 million, and it's hard to say exactly how many and exactly who will make that decision. But those people are tend to be a little bit healthier. If you have cancer, if you have had a heart attack, if you've had any serious illness, you're going to be very reluctant to drop your health insurance coverage. However, if you're basically healthy and maybe have one or two things wrong with you, you might say, I just don't have the money. And the problem with that is the people that remain in the plans are going to be sicker and sicker, and so the premiums will increase. So the premiums themselves are going to increase maybe 26% this year, simply because the insurers believe that the sick people will remain with coverage and the healthy people will drop coverage.
Let's hear from a Republican with an alternative. Here's Senator Bill Cassidy on Fox News Sunday.
So if we do continue the subsidies, you can put that over here, 100% going to the patient, and put it into a health savings account. They get a cheaper premium, and they get first dollar coverage. They have money in their account to pay for their daughter's sprained ankle.
All right, so what about that? Health savings accounts instead. How helpful could they be?
They would be great for the sprained ankle. If it's a small amount, it will be just fine to have a health savings account. However, if you have a serious illness, if you go to the hospital, the health savings account, which maybe will give you $3,000 or $4,000, will pay less than 1/10 of the cost of the hospitalization. So they're going to be absolutely no help at all.
Just a few seconds left. I mean, do you think there will ever be a U.S. healthcare system that both parties can agree on and say, this is it, this is what we got in the U.S.?
So I'm hoping that's the case, but I'm not optimistic. The real difference between the two sides is what I call the 20-80 rule. 20% of us incur 80% of the spending, and the Republicans are concerned about the 80% that are not sick, the 20% that are sick. That's where the Democrats are focused.
Gerald Anderson is a professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
KQED News and Morning Edition on this Monday at 7:19. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. Much more ahead on KQED from Morning Edition. Just a few moments. Let's check on the health of the commute around the Bay Area with Mel Baker taking us first to Irmonda.
24 eastbound at Wilder Road, an SUV struck a deer. The SUV's on the shoulder. We're not clear if the deer may be blocking a lane. Coming into Walnut Creek, basically from there up to the 242 merge, you can expect slow traffic on 680 southbound. Westbound 4 is really heavy this time of morning. It's pretty much stop and go all the way from Loveridge Road to Willow Pass Road. Mel Baker for KQED.
And traffic support comes to us from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and an onstage blizzard. Runs now to December 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. El Camino Health, open enrollment happens once a year. More about which health plans provide access to El Camino Health doctors and nationally recognized hospitals at elcaminohealth.org/open enrollment. Developing story up next on Morning Edition. It looks like a hostile bid for Warner Brothers Discovery from Paramount, challenging Netflix, which reached a $72 billion takeover deal with the company just days ago. More about the hostile bid coming up on KQED.
I'm Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., have you ever wanted to erase a painful memory? Neuroscientist Steve Ramirez has succeeded in turning memories on and off in mice and says that someday we'll be able to do the same in humans. But should we? We talked to Ramirez about the ethical dilemma and the personal experience that caused him to consider erasing his own memory. His new book is How to Change a Memory. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
Support for NPR comes from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com and by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED. Now 722.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Get out your popcorn. We've got more drama this morning in the fight over the media powerhouse Warner Brothers Discovery. Paramount now has launched a hostile bid for the company, making an appeal directly to shareholders. Just Friday, Netflix and Warner Brothers executives were celebrating the deal they had struck. NPR's David Fogenflick explains why Paramount wants to wipe the smile off their faces, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, David, let's get into it. What is Paramount doing and why?
They're launching what is a hostile bid. They're saying, you want money for this property? We'll give you a ton of money. They're offering enough that the deal would now be worth about $108 billion all in, including debt. Netflix had struck a deal that was worth about $83 billion, including debt. Paramount's looking at the landscape and saying, we're too small. We can't compete. Netflix is the world's largest streamer. It's the nation's largest streamer. There's also Amazon, which, yeah, it bought MGM, which is a small little studio, but it's, you know, Amazon has all the money in the world, the everything store. It's looking at Apple, and it's looking at Disney, which several years ago bulked up by acquiring most of the Murdoch's Fox Entertainment properties out there in Hollywood. Paramount says, look, if we combine together, we're two of the old-time studios, Paramount and Warner Brothers. We can do this. We have all these cable properties. You have cable properties. Let's be in business together. Let's take on these giants.
Okay, David, I mean, you mentioned Netflix is already the world's biggest streamer. So why do they want Warner Brothers Studios?
They want to scare off anyone else. They had said from the outset that they had a philosophy of not acquiring but building, and that has been something they've kept true to until now, where apparently as a head fake, they said throughout this process, we really don't want to be buying to build up. And yet they do. Now, they're not buying all of Warner Brothers Discovery. They want to buy Warner Brothers, the studios, the intellectual property from Casablanca to Batman, all the DC action heroes, Looney Tunes, the like. And they want HBO, one of, you know, the nation's, and in fact, internationally, leading streamers as well. They think this is something where they're going to really be able to hold off these competitors for sort of the second generation of Netflix success.
Would Paramount be any different as a buyer and owner than Netflix?
It sure would. If you think about the fate of the cable properties, the Netflix deal would spin those off. Paramount would take them on. CNN, most notably, but also TNT, TBS, Turner Sports, those would all remain part of the Paramount world, be combined. You know, if you think of CNN, the Ellison family, which acquired the parent company of CBS called Paramount Global just earlier this year, they want to get Warner Brothers as well, in part to take CNN and combine it with CBS News. There's the question of movies and theaters. The Netflix deal has promised to keep Warner Brothers movies in popular release in theaters, so you can see it with the buckets of popcorn you described earlier, right? But it's not clear how committed they are to that. Paramount says, look, we put movies out and we bring movies in. We stream them. We are the conventional model. Somehow we're going to figure out by getting much bigger, we're going to be able to figure out how to solve the knot of making real money in the streaming world. It's not clear that they will, but they certainly aren't going to do it as smaller. And they're also offering one other thing. They're saying we can get approval from regulators in the Trump administration because we have a connection.
That's interesting. What is the Trump factor here?
So the Ellison family is Larry Ellison. He's co-founder of Oracle, one of the wealthiest handful of people on the planet. His son, David, who was behind Skydance Media, which did, all the Mission Impossible films with Tom Cruise, is a significant movie producer. He pushed this takeover, this acquisition of Paramount Global because he wanted to get in big. They have really struck and forged an alliance with President Trump. Trump said just in the last 2 days that he will be involved in whether or not federal regulators approve Netflix's plan. That's, by the way, not supposed to be how this stuff works, but it is how things work in the Trump era. And so Trump has made clear that that's going to be a factor as well.
Where does everything go from here?
Well, leaving aside the political elements, there are very legitimate antitrust questions. You've seen senators from both parties on the Hill raise questions. You've seen state attorneys general suggest they may weigh in. There's the question of the cost, for example, to the consumer. It each costs about $18 a month for the standard ad-free version of Netflix or HBO. You can't think that fee is going to go lower if they combined or joined forces. So this is the kind of question that those antitrust regulators can consider. But also right now, you've got to imagine the Paramount bid has to go to the corporate boardroom of Warner Brothers Discovery. It could go to court. It's certainly going to regulators. As you say, a lot of drama.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Thank you.
You bet.
And we should mention that Warner Brothers Discovery is a financial sponsor of NPR.
A group of soldiers declared a military coup in the tiny West African country of Benin on Sunday. But almost as soon as it began, the government announced it had regained control. It's the latest in a wave of attempted coups in the region, as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
The opening scenes from an all-too-familiar script in West Africa.
Les Béninois, chers compatriotes.
On Sunday morning, gunshots were reported in the capital, Porto-Novo, shortly before soldiers took over the state broadcaster in Benin and gave a live address. They announced they had deposed President Patrice Talon and taken over the country, blaming corruption, growing insecurity near the northern border with West Africa's Sahel, and political repression. But the apparent coup was short-lived. Within a few hours, Benin's interior minister announced they had foiled the attempt. 14 soldiers were arrested, the government said. Airstrikes, apparently targeting the coup plotters, were later heard in the commercial capital, Cotonou, launched by Air Force jets sent from neighboring Nigeria.
À ces aventuriers et d'éviter le pire à notre pays.
Finally, on Sunday evening, President Talon addressed the country. He said the coup attempt had been foiled just over a year after a previous effort, and he said calm and normalcy had been restored. But there remain many unanswered questions on the true extent of the coup and its potential ripple effects. Talon has been in power since 2016 and was due to step down next April. The former businessman has faced accusations of authoritarianism in the tiny coastal nation that is fast developing and is largely viewed as more stable than many of its neighbors. But after several coups and attempted takeovers in West and Central Africa, the entire region is at alert. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
This is NPR News.
Well, we hate to tell you this. There's a big BART problem now. Mel Baker has details.
Boy, I hope this doesn't turn to be a BART meltdown. No red or green line service, limited blue line service between Dublin, Pleasanton, and West Oakland stations, and very limited service through on the Transbay Tube on the yellow line. There's been some sort of power problem between the around the Powell Street and Embarcadero stations. That's unclear whether that's affecting Muni. Muni has not made an announcement about any problems affecting underground light rail. We'll keep an eye on that for you. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thank you, Mel. Transit support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Picture House, presenting The Tale of Cillian, a story of resilience and a powerful connection between a down-on-his-luck farmer and a wounded white stork at the Roxy December 12th. Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. You're on KQED News. Good morning. I'm Dave Freeman. It's 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The San Francisco Sheriff's Deputy Association is calling for increased security at San Francisco General Hospital after a social worker who was stabbed by a patient died of their injuries over the weekend. The Chronicle's Annie Weinstein says staff raised concerns about the suspect weeks before the incident.
Staff there had been putting in calls asking for the situation to be escalated, and what we're hearing is that those pleas weren't taken seriously, or at least not seriously enough.
The city's Department of Public Health says it's taken steps to increase security. Neighborhood activists are pushing back against plans for a massive warehouse complex in San Francisco's Bayview that were greenlit by supervisors this month. KQED's Elise Manoukian was at a protest last week.
No more pollution!
No more pollution!
No more pollution!
A handful of activists are gathered outside the Prologis headquarters at Pier 1. They're protesting plans to transform multiple buildings into more than 2 million square feet of warehouse space. The project will contain a new e-commerce fulfillment center, likely for the current tenant, Amazon, and space for other industrial businesses. Rochelle Holmes, an activist with All Things Bayview, says it will add to the pollution in her neighborhood. Bayview residents already have higher asthma rates and shorter lifespans than the city overall.
We're still not okay with it. Just because they got authorized to do it, we're still going to fight them all the way until the building gets up, if it gets up.
You're not going to win, Prologis.
Rob Leachman, an industrial operations expert at UC Berkeley, says the project could actually reduce emissions by shortening delivery distances. In a statement, Prologis said it's proud to have the support of many in the Bayview and is committed to a building that meets the highest environmental standards. I'm Elise Manoukian, KQED News.
Hundreds of people in the Bay Area kicked off the holiday shopping season with an event to support local black-owned businesses. KQED's Billy Cruz was at an event, an annual event, Black Sunday, in Oakland yesterday.
Local clothing, art, and beauty products are on display, and tons of desserts and Jamaican food are on sale. It's the 8th annual Black Sunday holiday shopping experience where black-owned businesses from the area set up booths and highlight their goods. Author Shauna Bannis is showcasing her self-empowerment books and crochet work.
This was a great opportunity for black businesses to come out and show what they do, whether it's services or products in the community. And since I have a bit of both, I thought it would be a great opportunity for me as well.
Leaving with a bag full of recently purchased goodies is Margaret Carthel. She says she tries to come every year so she could get some holiday shopping done while also putting money back into the local black community.
I just like events like this because it keeps it in our neighborhood. All our commerce usually goes elsewhere. And this is a way to get us to sow back into the African American community like we sow into other communities.
A similar event highlighting local black-owned businesses, dubbed the Black Holiday Market, will take place at the San Francisco Ferry Plaza on Saturday. I'm Billy Cruz, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. More at KQED.org.
Plan on some cloudy skies, then sunny later today. Some morning dense fog to deal with if you're driving around the Bay Area. The same for the Sacramento Valley. Bay Area highs 50s to the mid-60s. Around Sacramento, 49 to 56 today. Support comes from Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport, Beauty, Pride, Love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. More at ms.now. And Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump is repeating a familiar pattern. He suggests a peace plan to end Russia's war in Ukraine. He or his negotiators talk to one side, then the other. And after talking to Russia, he puts President Volodymyr Zelensky on the spot.
Here's what Trump told reporters Sunday night at the Kennedy Center.
Russia is, I believe, fine with it, but I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it. His people love it, but he isn't ready.
Ukrainian officials have been calling for changes to that White House proposal, which they see as favoring, perhaps even written by, Russia.
NPR's Lauren Frayer is in London, where Zelensky is meeting with some of his European allies. So, Lauren, Zelensky called the weekend talks with President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff and his son-in-law Jared Kushner, quote, constructive, though not easy. Today in London, though, might be much different.
Much friendlier. Zelensky's meeting today with leaders of Britain, France, Germany. They're three of his biggest supporters, the three NATO countries with the biggest budgets besides the U.S., incidentally. And they're leading a coalition of the willing to help defend Ukraine with aid, with weapons, possibly even with French and British peacekeepers on the ground if and when there is a peace deal. I asked Mujtaba Rahman, the Europe managing director at the Eurasia Group. It's a risk analysis firm. And he said the goal of today's meetings is
for leaders to put their arms around Zelensky to demonstrate that Europe remains very supportive of Ukraine in the Ukraine position, and then to inch the substance more closely to the Ukrainian and the European position.
And this is the next step of that pattern you mentioned, a European leaders rallying behind Ukraine.
Now, late last week, the Trump administration published a revised national security strategy, which referenced Europe quite a bit. And Lauren, it seems like it's got a lot of people worried.
It sent chills down the backs of many leaders in Europe because it said immigration is leading to civilizational erasure in Europe. And it suggested that the U.S. would support far-right parties here. And perhaps most tellingly, the Kremlin spokesperson praised this document and said that it is in line with Russian President Vladimir Putin's vision. And so this document has sort of fueled suspicion already existing here in Europe that the Trump administration is more aligned with Russia than its longtime allies in the rest of Europe, both in general and in these Ukraine talks.
Okay, so then what does this then say about the U.S. relationship with Europe as well, and also maybe the role of Europe in these negotiations?
Yeah, it's another familiar pattern. You know, Europeans are fighting for a seat at the negotiating table here, and the Trump administration has been largely ignoring them. I mean, last week, a German magazine published a leaked transcript of a phone call among European leaders in which French President Macron and others said they're worried that the U.S. will betray Ukraine in these talks. And these are talks that involve European security. I mean, the U.K. says Russian submarine incursions into its own waters have jumped 30% in the past 2 years. So you've got Europe scrambling to fund its own defense now, defense that was largely sort of guaranteed by the U.S. since World War II. And that's no longer the case under the Trump administration.
That's NPR's Lauren Frayer in London. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
For more on how U.S. relations with Europe are changing in real time, we turn to Alexandra Tahoop-Scheffer to discuss this new national security memo from the Trump administration. She's president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a nonpartisan policy organization that works to advance U.S.-European cooperation. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So this new national security memo says the U.S. should cultivate, quote, resistance to Europe's current trajectory and should stop NATO from perpetually expanding. When you hear that, resist this current trajectory, stop NATO from expanding, what do you think?
In addition to that, what you're seeing is probably an increasing gap when it comes to values, when it comes to norms. However, there is a non-negotiable requirement for Europe and the United States to redefine their relationship, their cooperation, probably much more in terms of shared interests than shared value.
This document is out. It really shows that the administration views its relationship with foreign powers really not as a source of freedom in the world, as the U.S. has often seen itself, but a place to reduce migration in the West and to have transactional and financially lucrative relationships. So how should Europe respond in this moment?
Well, Europe needs to do three things simultaneously. One is continue to partner with the United States when interests align. Number two, Europe will have to go it alone when interests diverge. And then number three, Europe will have to build alliances with other like-minded powers. You've seen it over the past months with Indo-Pacific countries, but also Middle Eastern countries and Latin American countries. So I would say what you are seeing live today is a new transatlantic bargain where Europeans are accepting and integrating the idea that the transatlantic relationship is going to be more transactional, more conditional, and that includes collective defense. And so this is the time for Europe to step up, to reduce its strategic dependencies vis-a-vis the United States, while at the same time preserving the transatlantic link.
What are the implications for the U.S. as it shifts its strategy and other places change their view of the U.S. and their relationship with the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. is reordering its global priorities around its core interests and not historical relationships. And you see it with the ranking, right? It's the Western Hemisphere first, it's China second, and then it's Europe third. And so from a U.S. perspective, the expectations towards Europeans in terms of taking more responsibility for their own security, their own defense, is going to be on the top of the U.S. transatlantic agenda.
And you mentioned the war in Ukraine. What could this all mean for that?
Yes. Well, I think on Ukraine, what you're seeing is Washington on the one side wanting speed. Europe on the other side needs long-term security, stability, and needs to avoid a frozen conflict on its doorstep. At the end of the day, this so-called peace plan is actually going to define the terms of the future NATO-EU-Russia relationship. This is going to be Trump's peace deal. And so what Europeans want to do is co-offer this peace deal to be sure that it's going to be a sustainable one, both for Ukraine, but for their own security.
We'll have to leave it there. Alexandra de Hoop Scheffer is president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Transit traffic, it's BART. Here's Mel Baker.
So we're learning some more details. First of all 50 stations are open. It is possible to get anywhere within the system this morning. It may require some transfers and some patience. There is no red or green line service through the Transbay Tube. Red and green line is running in the East Bay. There is limited yellow line service through the tube and limited blue line service, again, in the East Bay. So you can get around. You'll have to have some patience. There's been some sort of power outage between Powell and Embarcadero. Crews are on the scene trying to repair that. As far as we can tell, it's not affecting any of the Muni underground, and it is not affecting surface power above that in San Francisco. Mel Baker for KQED.
Transit support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Apocalypse in the Tropics. The documentary by Petra Costa investigates the fast rise of the evangelical movement in Brazil and the consequences for politics and democracy. Now on Netflix, awards eligible. VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com.
Coming up next on the California Report, police in San Diego County aren't just using their own license plate cameras. They're also tapping into private cameras at malls, big box stores, even homeowner associations. I'm Adi Bolaños. A KPBS investigation found these networks are operating with very little oversight. Supporters say the system helps solve crimes. Critics worry it's a major privacy risk. That's ahead on the California Report.
On KQBD News at 8:51.
For decades, Alice Wong spoke of the need for disabled people to advocate loudly for their own health needs. It's been less than a month since Alice Wong's death, and I wanted to know who in her community is going to keep this fight going, this fight for disability justice. I'm Carlos Cabrera Lomelí, and I'm the community engagement reporter at KQED. You can find my story about Alice Wong's legacy at kqed.org.
Monday forecast for the Bay Area, some cloudiness and areas of dense fog this morning. Clearing, becoming sunnier today. Dry weather right through the weekend, it looks like. Today's highs in the Bay, lower 50s to the mid-60s. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And by the sustaining members of KQED. I'm Dave Freeman, Monday morning. Good morning, it's 7:46.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Late fall and early winter is deer hunting season in many parts of the U.S. Most hunters headed into the field will be armed with bullets made of lead, which is toxic for predators that eat animals shot by hunters and left behind. As Maine Public's Peter McGuire reports, some hunters are now pushing to ditch lead bullets for good. And a warning, this story includes the sound of gunfire.
At Avian Haven in Freedom, Maine, it's feeding time at the bald eagle enclosure. Executive Director Barbara Haney says that out of the 36 eagles brought into the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center last year, 75% had lead poisoning.
That's a lot. That actually corresponds with the statistics that we're getting from other rehab centers as well.
Sick birds are so weak that they can't hold their heads or wings up. They're confused and unfocused. Some live, but others are too far gone. And Haney says hundreds of lead fragments left in animal remains after they're hit with a bullet is the only source of that contamination. She says a lead fragment the size of a grain of rice is enough to kill an eagle.
If we can do a simple thing like cut back on the amount of lead that's in the environment, it's going to make a huge impact on our wildlife.
Decades after the U.S. banned lead in gasoline, paint, and water pipes, lead hunting bullets are still very common. But Brian Bedrosian thinks it doesn't have to be that way. He's a Wyoming hunter and founder of Sporting Lead Free, a group that has ambassadors across the country persuading hunters to pick solid copper bullets instead. Copper bullets don't fragment when they hit an animal.
Hunters are the original conservationists. This should be something that we should all try and get behind.
Bedrosian says the effort could take a couple generations, but momentum is growing. He says copper bullets used to be uncommon, but are getting cheaper and more available all the time, even though lead bullets still cost less. And most hunters care about wildlife and the environment. That's why Bedrosian says persuasion is more effective than government bans on lead ammo.
If you encourage and inform people why they need to make the choice, you're going to be much more successful than trying to force them to make an action where they don't understand the why.
All right, I'm going hot.
Yep, going hot.
At a gun range in Scarborough, Maine, Tim Summers peers through the scope of his deer rifle and gets ready to squeeze off a shot to sight in the gun.
It's on the target that would have killed deer.
Summers says he's never tried copper bullets, but he eats the meat from the animals he kills, so he's willing to give non-lead ammo a try.
You think about it, it's a little pellet at the end of the day of lead. You know, if that shatters and gets into the meat and stuff of an animal, then, you know, you could be ingesting quite a bit of it, I guess.
Charlie Largay is the supervisor at the range. He's been a hunter and a competitive shooter most of his life. These days, Largay only uses copper bullets.
It's just as accurate, if not more so. And it doesn't leave the residue behind. I mean, we don't need the woods full of lead.
There's precedent for this kind of phase-out. It's against federal law to hunt ducks and geese with lead shot. And Largay says lead ammo is still fine to use for target shooting.
Typically, if you're a deer hunter or you're hunting most game, you're going to get one shot.
And Largay says there's no need for that bullet to contain lead. For NPR News, I'm Peter McGuire in Scarborough, Maine.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldick.
All right, let's get an update on the BART delay and the latest KQED traffic, all of that with Mel Baker.
Currently, there's only the yellow line passing through the Transbay Tube. The other trains are stopping at the other ends, so be prepared for some delays and a lot of transfers to get around. This is due to a power outage. San Francisco 101 southbound before Cesar Chavez. Reports of a trash can and other debris on fire off the shoulder. Fire crews checking that out. In Brisbane, 101 southbound's off-ramp to Bayshore Boulevard is partially blocked by a major stall. Mel Baker. For KQED.
Traffic transit support from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. It's the Monday Marketplace Morning Report at 7:51. The Supreme Court will hear arguments today on the legality of President Trump's decision to fire a commissioner, of the Federal Trade Commission. Get the latest on the case and what it could mean for consumers. Also, would you use AI to shop for the holidays? Hear why more consumers are turning to chatbots for gift-giving advice. All of that and more in a minute.
Hi, it's Peter Sagal from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm already drafting my New Year's resolutions. Among them, next year, I'm going to start drafting my resolutions even earlier. And, you know, well, read more books and stuff. But I'm also going to keep asking you to support public radio, because some things I just don't need to change. Thanks.
Visit kqed.org/donate.
Monday marks 1 year since Syria's former dictator Bashar al-Assad fled the country. We check in with Syrians we first spoke to back then to see how their lives have changed since. Hear that story and more next time on The World.
Today at 2. At 4 Marketplace, in states that have declined to expand Medicaid coverage, working people just above the poverty line have relied on federal subsidies to pay their premiums. But now those subsidies are going away. More on the story and the rest of the day's financial news on Marketplace, 4 p.m. this afternoon, and again at 6:30 p.m. right here on KQED News.
Can AI do better than slippers or a necktie?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, invoicing, and more to help entrepreneurs manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, the Supreme Court is set to hear arguments today in Trump versus Slaughter, a case that has broad implications for consumers and workers. Does a president have the power to fire the leaders of independent federal agencies? In this case, the Federal Trade Commission. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
The case involves President Trump's firing of Rebecca Slaughter. She was a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC was created in 1914 as part of congressional trust busting. Since then, the agency has brought a number of antitrust cases, including against big tech companies like Meta. The FTC's mission is to protect consumers from monopolies and deceptive practices. The heads of agencies like the FTC are meant to be insulated from politics. This case could affect top officials at other agencies meant to protect consumers and workers, such as the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Merit Systems Protection Board, and National Labor Relations Board. The court will consider another case along these lines next month, President Trump's attempt to fire Lisa Cook, a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. It's not clear whether the Supreme Court will give the Fed a carve-out protecting its independence. The law only allows a president to fire a Fed board member for cause. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Like the hovering salesperson who insists on offering you help, there may be artificial intelligence breathing down your neck as you shop, or maybe you're asking for a little help from AI these days. So far this season of consumption, traffic to retail sites pushed along by AI is up nearly eightfold from last year, according to Adobe Analytics. For instance, Walmart has an AI shopping assistant called Sparky. Amazon has Rufus. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
Luca Sion was fresh out of gift ideas for a friend who's into dressing up, so he turned to an AI chatbot, which recommended an appointment with a fashion consultant.
something that on a stage didn't know existed. And so I thought it was a cool idea.
Sion, a marketing professor at the University of Virginia, says shoppers also use AI to compare the features and prices of products like TVs and vacuum cleaners.
There are so many products and we have so many choices. And so instead of me spending hours reading through a lot of websites, I have someone or something better reading.
Where AI falls short is the subjective stuff. Picking out a sweater requires a sense of personal aesthetics. Aaron Cheris, who leads the global retail practice at Bain, says it also has a tough time with intricate orders, but imagines a future where you could give a chatbot your grocery list.
40 items from this retailer, 20 items from this retailer, and 15 from this retailer, and I'll save you $10.
Cheris says that will require consumers' trust. For instance, what if chatbots start partnering with brands for product placement?
Do I still trust that when I asked it to get me the best deal on everything, it's really getting me the best deal?
It'll be up to shoppers to decide. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Now, this morning I asked the Amazon shopping AI what I should get for myself, and it suggested a deck of 52 cards each with a workout exercise. What exactly are you trying to tell me, Mr. Rufus AI? Markets, the Dow is down 144 points, 0.3% now. The S&P is down 0.3% as well. The NASDAQ is down 0.1%. Going into this last weekend, Netflix appeared to have won the competition to buy the studio Warner Brothers Discovery, a friendly bid. But just now, there's word of a hostile bid from rival Paramount, which is offering shareholders $108 billion, 30% higher than Netflix. These deals could both draw antitrust scrutiny.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
Now to finding work after rehab. It can be an uphill climb, sometimes with gaps in employment history or debt. In the woods and lakes of northern Michigan, there are a number of rehab centers generating thousands of alumni a year, and at least one employer is making a point to hire them. It's a wood manufacturing company with a labor shortage. Claire Keenan-Kurgan of Interlochen Public Radio has the story of not a halfway but a three-quarters house where staff and recovery share a home together.
Inside this wood factory in Petoskey, Michigan, Stephanie Costi looks at the list of work orders for her day producing wood veneers. The veneer she's working on could become a guitar.
It becomes doors. Oh my goodness. It's a whole list. It makes a lot of stuff.
She's been at this job for about a year and a half. She found it after leaving rehab here in Petoskey.
I was addicted to heroin and meth for about 10 years. I lost my kids. I lost my house. I lost everything.
That all happened in her old town, Battle Creek, Michigan. After coming up here for rehab in northern Michigan, she didn't want to go back. This job at the wood plant, it allowed her to stay. She works for Abe Monti, one of the owners of the company here. He says they realized they needed more staff during COVID, when orders for new kitchen cabinets were pouring in. So they started posting flyers in the rehab centers in town.
People are coming from other places to those inpatient centers, and they don't want to go back home, you know, because they want to restart their life.
People were taking the jobs, but they needed housing and sometimes help staying sober. They decided to take a renovated motel that they already used for employee housing and make it a sober house. There's a recovery coach on site.
Not just substance use coaching, it's life skill coaching. So it's get your driver's license back, it's help save money for a car.
Peggy Swarbrick, a professor at Rutgers University who studies addiction recovery, says that for people re-entering life sober,
employment, having a purposeful, meaningful structure to your day is essential.
Monte thinks other companies, especially in rural areas with rehab centers, could make this work too, if they have the right recovery coach to guide people. Stephanie Costi, the one working at the plant, is starting to rebuild her life. She just moved into her own house. She has hobbies for the first time in her adult life.
I'm coming up on 2 years clean in February, and I'm still trying to piece together who I am.
And who she wants to be. Eventually, her goal is to become a recovery coach herself. In Petoskey, Michigan, I'm Claire Keenan-Kurgan for Marketplace.
In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. We're from APM, American Public Media.
Oh, we only have half a minute or so. So many traffic and transit problems all of a sudden. Here's Mel Baker.
Santa Rosa 101 northbound between Hearn Avenue and College Avenue slows southbound between Airport Boulevard and College Avenue. Nearly stopped traffic in Nevada from that earlier sig alert. 101 southbound between DeLong and Freitas Parkway. That's cleared. New changes on BART. Expect delays. You can get around in the system. I'm going to have you give you new updates that we just heard from BART at 06. Mel Baker. For KQED.
Traffic transit support from Gleim the Jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Frontline PBS presenting 2,000 Meters to Andrika, a documentary about Ukrainian soldiers fighting for every inch of their land in Russia-Ukraine war. Now streaming on PBS.org and the PBS app. Awards eligible. You're